Well, True Crime Tuesday is not for the faint of heart, and today is no different. We bring you two stories. One involves a real-life monster who inspired the Scream movies. But before we get to that story, I want to tell you about a once bright Broadway star by the name of Margaret Lawrence.
Margaret Lawrence was one of those long-time, young, up-and-coming Broadway stars. She was born somewhere in the upper East Coast, you know, very highfalutin counties.
Germantown, Pennsylvania.
That's where it is.
She became a fairly successful actress in her late teens. She had a steady succession of stage roles that took advantage of her good looks. She had a flair for comedy. By 1910, she's barely 20 years old, and she is appearing regularly on Broadway, living the dream.
Well, she falls in love. It's a question mark because it didn't last for very long. But she falls in love with a patent lawyer, much older patent lawyer, and had a couple of kids. She gave birth to two daughters.
As you can imagine, the Broadway career went by the wayside when she's making the babies. And as you can imagine, a woman who was once a star on Broadway suddenly thrust into the life of a housewife and young mom, that's not going to go over so well.
Well, you know what they say about the neon lights on Broadway?
What do they say?
They say they're bright.
And she missed the brightness.
Yeah.
So she got a divorce. She returns to the stage, and she soon marries a guy by the name of Wallace Edinger. Wallace Edinger is a well-known actor, frequent co-star of Margaret's. But Margaret starts developing a bit of a problem.
She likes the drink.
She likes the bottle. And the husband dies of pneumonia. And that's when things really start to go down the tunnel for Margaret.
Part of it was the husband that died of pneumonia. Her mother actually was battling Margaret Lawrence in court for control of the estate, accusing her of being drunk in front of her young kids. And I mean, this is high value stuff for the tabloids there in New York.
The roles start to dry up because the booze continued to flow.
Ooh, I like that.
And she was suspended for 6 months by her union because she kept failing to show up for rehearsals.
Well, she eventually starts up a new relationship with a 45-year-old guy named Louis Bennison.
Bennison,
also a well-known actor, made his name on the stage, spent part of his early career playing cowboys in the silent movies out here in California.
He hooks up with Margaret and he drops his wife and children who live in California for Margaret. Now, once a star just like Margaret in his own right, he hadn't worked steadily for quite some time. And you know what else he liked? Just like Margaret?
The bottle.
He turned to the bottle as soon as that career began to bottom out. He was also a very jealous man. He rarely let Margaret out of his sight. He'd also taken to carrying a revolver.
Yeah, here's the thing. They get drunk. They get drunk together. They get drunk more and more often. Nobody wants to give them a job on Broadway, off-Broadway, off-Broadway. So they live in a rooftop apartment in Midtown, 10-story apartment house, which was actually a pretty nice place. Except when their roles dry up and the money stops coming in, the only thing that's keeping them together is their love of the alcohol.
She can't keep house. That place looks shabby, unkept, an unhappy home littered with empty bottles of bootleg rye that reeked with the stench of failure, despair.
Well, one day,
a woman by the name of Mrs. Gertrude Schiller, who was a lifelong friend of Margaret.
Yeah, Margaret comes to Gertrude Schiller, and Margaret says to her, "Hey, I'm going to give you this key to my apartment because Louis threatened me, and I know he's carrying a gun around. Look in once in a while and keep your eye on us," she told Gertrude Schiller.
So Gertrude is giving Margaret a little ring on the phone, and Margaret's not answering. And so she tries her again and again. It's nearly 2 p.m., and usually Margaret's shaken off last night's bender by now.
She may have even started the next day.
Sure, but this woman, Gertrude, just felt in her gut that something horrible had happened. So, using that key that Margaret recently gave her, she let herself into the dark apartment littered with the bootleg
hooch.
She finds Margaret in bed. Margaret is wearing a silk nightgown, and she's lying on her back with her eyes closed. Gertrude would say she looked like she was in a deep, peaceful slumber.
Well, she leaned forward to try to shake Margaret awake and stopped when she realized that there was a small dark circle on Margaret's left breast right over her heart.
And all of a sudden, she sees the red stain on the sheets under the body, and she starts screaming.
And runs out of the apartment. Now, she had been too shocked at the sight of her friend to actually see what went on in the entire apartment. But when the police finally showed up and they opened up the curtains to let in the light, on the other side of the bed, they found another body, a middle-aged man frozen in what they said was a bizarre death pose. His knees were on the floor as if he was in prayer, and his head and torso resting against the side of the bed. And he, too, had been shot in the heart.
On the floor beside him was that revolver that he had taken to carrying, a six-shooter, like the ones from a good old Western, and there were two empty cartridges in the cylinder. That man was Louis Bennison.
The city's newspapers, of course, the tabloids loved this couple because it gave them so much fodder, and they originally said that this may have been a suicide pact, but detectives said they figured out that it was a murder-suicide, that, in fact, Louis had shot Margaret straight in the heart and then turned the gun on himself.
Now, tragic end for a once famous couple.
The Daily News columnist who covered the story way back when, in the roaring 20s, said, Margaret Lawrence is dead, the pitiful victim of her own weaknesses, and Bennison is dead, the victim of the cheaper actor's ego, a weak stomach, and the sort of liquor prohibition has provided.
Damn. They wrote well back in the day.
Sure did.
Well, speaking of bizarre death poses, we've got another story for you on this True Crime Tuesday. Again, not for the faint of heart when we come back.
And your chance at $1,000.
So back to the University of Florida in Gainesville. August 1990, two students, Sonia and Christina, found dead in their shared apartment. Police had to break down a door to get to the girls. They were both dead, repeatedly stabbed, bodies mutilated. Killer left them in provocative poses with their arms extended above their heads. There was a book written on the case. A Monster of All Time is what it was called. Just 8 hours later, deputies from the county sheriff's office went to the home of Krista Hoyt, 18 years old, worked as a dispatcher for the department. I found that to be interesting that they would hire an 18-year-old to be a sheriff's department dispatcher. But maybe it's not a 911 dispatcher. Maybe it's like a security dispatch.
Non-emergency.
Right, non-emergency.
Maybe.
She had not shown up for her shift that day. Well, they find Krista in her bedroom, mutilated. Again, her body posed as if she was sitting up. Her hands were on her thighs. Her head was across the room.
Whoa.
Propped up on a bookshelf, looking out as if it was surveying the scene. 2 days later, there were two more bodies, roommates Tracy and Manuel, both 23, killed in their apartment. All the women were young petite brunettes, so police immediately began to think that the killings were connected.
For a short time, they actually thought they had a suspect, a local college student with a bad drug habit. He'd been behind bars for punching his own grandmother, but they still couldn't connect him to the murders. And then they went through and found other area cold cases. A triple murder in November of 89 in Louisiana that had some similarities in that there were three people, a father, his daughter, and then the grandson that were stabbed. The woman was also a petite brunette. The body had been mutilated and posed after death, so they thought that that may have been a connection.
As you can imagine, this was all over the news. People were panicked. Citizens were stocking up on guns, mace, other weapons. Students put their studies on hold. They packed up. They went home. Some people thought it would be a copycat following in the footsteps of Ted Bundy. people were looking for somebody who looked like Ted Bundy. But the Gainesville Ripper, as the press had dubbed him, did not really fit the profile. Then one day, police are called to the scene of a Winn-Dixie where there had been a guy who burst in with a gun during peak business hours and robbed the place. Employee calls 911. Police turn up on the vehicle. High-speed chase begins. He crashes his car, tries to run off, but he could not get away.
The judge considers this a lengthy criminal record that this guy's got. Daniel Rowling includes multiple robberies, an attempt to murder his police officer father, and he imposed a life sentence. They used a DNA test by using a sample of his blood obtained during a tooth extraction, provided a tentative connection to the murder. Other forensic tests later strengthened that link.
And they got their guy. When they looked into his background, they found the classic recipe for a serial killer: bad childhood, abusive father, molested by a cousin, bad school record, series of illnesses. And a key ingredient, they say, there was a fall in which he hit his head and was never quite the same. Then came the drugs, jail, a bad marriage, and a divorce.
He was eventually sentenced to death, but he couldn't resist telling his cellmate about a bunch of murders. And after several interviews with somebody who became interested, she actually proposed to him. He became a media star. Then he offered detectives a detailed confession of rapes and murders that took place before the rampage at Gainesville.
During his years on death row, he wrote and created artwork for murderabilia websites. And after watching a special about this guy, there was a young actor and writer by the name of Kevin Williamson, and he banged out a script based on the crimes. Miramax bought it for $400,000, and the teen horror comedy launched the Scream movie franchise and Williamson's career.
They are making a fifth Scream movie, by the way.
Yeah.
It turns out that Neve Campbell will be reprising her role as Sydney Prescott in the Scream film. And that same month of May of last year, David Arquette said he'd come back and reprise his role of Dewey Riley. So,
coming back from True Crime Tuesday to Tasty Tuesday, it's our favorite season here on the Gary and Shannon Show. Apple season.
I'm in.
Love me an apple.
Gary and Shannon.
Forgot my apple today.
We'll continue in just a moment.
# sad face.